Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. I'd like to welcome you to a special, in-depth, original investigative reporting series on the JFK assassination. Today, the motivation in the military and intelligence complex for eliminating JFK so they could continue the U.S.'s wars of aggression against communism. My guest, James Douglas. James Douglas has been leading the anti-war and anti-nuclear activities in the tradition of Thomas Merton, beginning when he was a professor of religion at the University of Hawaii, a Christian theologian and author of JFK and the Unspeakable. This text has been considered by many as the single most authoritative work providing the motivation and historical rationale for the CIA and military-industrial complex to eliminate President John Kennedy. It served as a fundamental resource for Oliver Stone's film JFK and has been praised by Daniel Ellsberg and doubters of the Warren Commission throughout the JFK research community. In 1975, James Douglas founded Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action to protest the construction of the Trident missile nuclear submarine. He has participated in several peace missions, including Iraq. He is a member and co-founder of Religious Leaders for 9/11 Truth and founder of Mary's House in Birmingham, Alabama, which provides services to the homeless community there. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
One of the mysteries that have baffled JFK researchers has been the dramatic and radical turn in Kennedy's foreign policy. When Kennedy entered the White House, he was aligned with the aggressive stance of the U.S. military and intelligence complex towards communism, especially the Soviet Union and Cuba, and to a lesser extent, Vietnam at that time. The entire atmosphere and climate of the Cold War in the early 1960s seemed to hinge upon a great game of whether nuclear would commence between the two great powers, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, that would destroy much of humanity. And this was the geopolitical world that JFK entered as the leader of one of the great world powers. So I'd like you to begin, please, and take your time to discuss the causes behind Kennedy's dramatic shift to becoming a leader for peace between the Soviet Union and Cuba, but there was also peaceful overtures in dealing with Vietnam and Laos, Indonesia, and of course his signing of the nuclear test ban treaty with Nikita Khrushchev. For example, his obsession with death, and then speak about the evidence in JFK's own words and from those he shared conversations with that reveal that he was aware that he was putting his life in jeopardy by standing up against the war hawks in the government. For example, his premonitions and hints to others that he would be done away with. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Well, I guess the places to begin is with the character of the man. And you mentioned death, which was always on his shoulder. It was, from childhood, a constant presence with him. He was, as his brother often described him, always ill, always sick in one form or another. And we know the way in which he almost died in the South Pacific when he was on his PT boat, which was cut in two by a Japanese ship, and he and his crew were cast into the water, and he saved the lives of several men. Several died, and at one point he swam into the middle of a channel and tried to hail down another PT boat with a lantern, and in the course of losing consciousness, drifted right out toward the Pacific Ocean, and a current brought him back to where he had started, and when he regained consciousness, he was back into possible life again. There were many instances in which JFK almost died, and he began to look on death through those experiences as something that was not to be feared. He taught Jacqueline, his wife, the poem, "I Have a Rendezvous with Death," by Alan Seeger, who, like Jack Kennedy, had gone to Harvard and also went to war, First World War in Seeger's case, and who died. And in anticipation of that death, he wrote this very moving poem. And the story that hits one most deeply about that poem and Kennedy having it continually in his consciousness is the day in October 1963 when he was having a National Security Council meeting with his key advisors and his daughter, 5-year-old daughter at that time. Caroline was tugging at his coat and then finally gained his attention, and he focused entirely on her. And as the National Security advisors listened in a kind of daze to what was going on, Caroline recited this poem that she had been taught in turn by her mother, "I Have a Rendezvous with Death." So there he is, seated with people, some of whom I think it is likely knew he was going to be killed and would have his rendezvous with death. And there he was, looking into the eyes of his daughter and hearing that, "I have a rendezvous with death," which ends in his commitment, the poet's and JFK's, not to fail that rendezvous. So death, yeah, death. He didn't fear it. He embraced it. And that's the key, I think, to the whole story. But there is a lot more to it than that, in the sense that he had a background both in the war and in the Senate when he stood for nationalist forces in the Third World, especially in Vietnam and Algeria, made very courageous speeches that tipped his hat to the world that he wasn't going to be mirror of Eisenhower when he came into office. So Lumumba's assassination with the complicity of the CIA 3 days before JFK took office was no accidental timing. They wanted to get Lumumba before Kennedy became president, because Kennedy was on the side of Lumumba, and his speeches during his presidential election relate to Africa and the Congo a huge number of times. There are a number of tips before he even gets into office as what direction he may be willing to go, even though he was campaigning as a cold warrior. So yes, he came in as a cold warrior, and he turned significantly, as I outline in the story, through the Bay of Pigs, where he realized he was being duped, lied to, told there would be a big uprising by the Cubans in response to Fidel Castro, when that wasn't the case at all, told there would be terrain in which the brigade would go guerrilla, in which there was no such terrain. He responded to that by saying, "I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds." And he began doing so by firing the most powerful man in the Cold War, Alan Dulles, his chief deputies. He fired Cabell, General Cabell. He fired Richard Bissell. He was not playing around. And of course, General Cabell would be in the background of Dallas, in as much as his brother was the mayor of Dallas when John Kennedy died. Alan Dulles would return to power as the most powerful person in the so-called Warren Commission, steering the commission to its lone assassin conclusion. But the deepest point at which we see Kennedy's turning is not simply the Bay of Pigs, but in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And in the darkest hour, when Kennedy feels he's losing control, when Curtis LeMay is pushing his bombers past the turnaround point toward the Soviet Union, baiting the Soviets, when Curtis LeMay, Air Force Chief of Staff, is firing, so-called test firing, a test missile into the Pacific, which the Russians could just as easily have as interpreted as an attack upon them, when Curtis LeMay is trying to get the Soviets to make a move so that the U.S. can retaliate with far more powerful nuclear forces, and when he's taunting Kennedy in meetings that we hear on tape recordings that Kennedy was making and that are now available to every American citizen via the JFK library, Kennedy, knowing that kind of thing was going on, he sent his brother Robert, the Attorney General, to Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador in Washington, and said that the president was profoundly concerned and they had to reach an agreement very quickly, or there would be nuclear war. He was losing control, and he said through Robert that if Khrushchev pulled his missiles out of Cuba, the exchange that Khrushchev had said would only be apt tit for tat, and which Kennedy saw the perfect logic of, namely withdrawing our missiles from Turkey. Kennedy said that would happen, but it couldn't happen right now and publicly. There's no way to negotiate it through NATO in an hour or two, or even in a few days, and they had to do the exchange quickly. So he said they'd be out, but the Soviets had to trust him. trust between the two biggest enemies in the Cold War. And when Khrushchev received the message from Dobrynin, that was when Khrushchev turned to his foreign minister and said, "We have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him." We know all this through Nikita Khrushchev's son and through documents from Dobrynin to Khrushchev, from Khrushchev's own memoirs. We have multiple documentation of what was going on then. And Khrushchev couldn't believe it himself when he was saying that the step had to be made to help the enemy. And then he said, "Yes, help. We now have a common cause to save those pushing us toward war." And at that point, the whole Cold War turned upside down, and Nikita Khrushchev and John F. Kennedy became closer to each other than either was to his own national security state. And from that point on, the American University Address, June 10, 1963, JFK calling for an end to the Cold War, his reaching out to the Russians by embracing their suffering in the Second World War in that remarkable speech, certainly the most powerful of his presidency and of his life, his signing of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty 6 weeks later with Khrushchev, an extraordinary negotiation in which the negotiator was JFK himself, doing it directly from the White House. Every time there was a question in negotiations, his man in Moscow would simply run to the phone and call JFK, and JFK would have the answer, and that's the way it went. They had it done by the end of July. Then it was a huge turnaround in American public opinion, organized by Kennedy, working with peace and justice people, with labor leaders, with scientists, with religious leaders. He had them together in the White House. Norman Cousins did the ground roots organizing, women's magazine editors, They turned public opinion around, got the test ban treaty passed. Then he was doing back-channel negotiations with Castro right up to the day on which JFK died. His man, Jean Daniel, his unofficial representative, a man from Paris, reporter who interviewed him in the White House and basically took the whole attitude of Kennedy word for word down to Castro, met all night with Castro, then met again with him on the afternoon of November 22, 1963. And when the word came in that the president had been shot and then killed, Fidel Castro, who had been joking with Daniel that he was so hopeful about Kennedy that he was prepared to endorse Kennedy's opponent in the next election so that Kennedy would win it, Castro stands up and he says, everything has changed. Everything is going to change. And then the final nail in the coffin of John F. Kennedy that happened a month before that end of Cuban-American hope was National Security Memorandum 263, in which JFK said 1,000 troops out of Vietnam by the end of 1963 and the bulk of U.S. troops out by the end of 65, all of which was turned around by LBJ in 3 days, meeting with Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, who opposed all of JFK's ventures that fall in Vietnam, the U.S. ambassador blocking every move he made toward peace. That's a very quick summary.
I appreciate it. It's in your work, JFK and the Unspeakable.
Yes.
I believe you use the term unspeakable in the sense of the Catholic Trappist monk and activist Thomas Merton used
yes.
it in an essay, Raids of the Unspeakable, which refers to evil that goes beyond the words we are capable of describing it. And also, I believe that you refer to that as evident in our violence in Vietnam, our military complexes, willingness to start a nuclear war, the assassination of not just JFK, but also, I believe, RFK and Martin Luther King as part
and
of that.
And Malcolm X.
Malcolm X. And then you look today. You look at now it's out in the open. Now we know that the president meets on a weekly basis to decide who he's going to kill without any due process, without any sense
yes.
of irony that we promote the concept of the rule of law, and yet these people are given no opportunity. They're over a certain age. They're killed. We call them a terrorist, a suspect. And just imagine then when the media says that there was only one lone assassin and no one else was involved, when any even minor league scholar of limited ability could find multiple contradictions and discrepancies in the Warren report. So take us now to a different discussion. Take us to the discussion when it comes to of Lee Harvey Oswald and how they tried to pin everything on Lee Harvey Oswald.
Well, Lee Harvey Oswald, as we know now from multiple documentation, the evidence that was never stated in the Warren report, he was CIA from 1957-58 when he had been a top secret U-2 radar operator for the U-2 spy plane. He was at Atsugi Air Force Base in Japan. He was monitoring the U-2 spy plane. And when he then, after being in the Marines, working with the CIA, resigned while he was discharged for a very questionable medical reason, and then when he defected, and I put that in quotation marks, to the Soviet Union from 1959 to 1962, he said he was turning over classified radar information to the Russians. And yet, after being in the Soviet Union for that period of time, turning over information that would have made him a traitor, he was given U.S. State Department funding to return to the country he'd betrayed. That is so preposterous a story. We are not given it in any detailed fashion in the Warren report. So you just have to scratch the surface to begin to get into the story of Oswald. Excuse me. And then when he gets to Fort Worth and Dallas in 1962, after he returns to the United States with his Russian wife and daughter, he's welcomed by a CIA asset, George de Morenshield, who became his mentor. And that's at the instigation of a CIA domestic contact service chief, Walton Moore, J. Walton Moore. Oswald is being moved around like a pawn on a chessboard at the same time as Kennedy, by the time that Oswald is in Fort Worth and Dallas, Kennedy is turning the chessboard over. He's at that point making his American University address, and Oswald is being moved into place with his associations with Fidel Castro, working with the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans, and then especially in Mexico City, being painted as a person who's associated with the man in the Soviet consulate who is in charge of assassinations throughout the Western Hemisphere. This is an Oswald who is being groomed for his role as a patsy, as a target in the assassination, who will implicate Cuba and the Soviet Union. So the more we get into the nature of the plot around Oswald, the more darkness there is, because it has a twofold purpose. It is not only to kill the President of the United States, who is seeking peace with the Soviet Union and Cuba. It is also to use the assassination itself as a basis for attacking Cuba and the Soviet Union. Oswald, or someone impersonating him, is visiting both embassies in Mexico City, both the Cuban and the Soviet embassies, consulates, and is acting in such a way as to implicate himself in relation to an event that will take place on November 22. So the purpose of the assassination, fortunately, to use it as a basis for attack against Cuba and the Soviet Union, which is a very dark underlying stream of evidence, was not realized, because Johnson did not want to begin his presidency with a nuclear war, so he balked at that one. And in order to cover up the evidence, which pointed toward the CIA, not Cuba and the Soviet Union, if you got very much into the evidence, because there were just too many Oswalds running around. I cite a series of them, especially in Dallas on November 22nd. That part of the plot was not realized, but the first part was. And when people ask what was Oswald doing at particular points in Dallas on November 22, the obvious question in response, if you know the evidence, is which Oswald do you mean? Do you mean the Oswald who was arrested and taken out the front of the Texas Theater? You mean the Oswald who was taken out the back of the Texas Theater a few minutes later? I interviewed witnesses that spoke of both Oswalds.
Could you give us more detail on that, please?
There's a man named Butch Burroughs, who was the man inside the Texas Theater, who was at the candy counter when Oswald came into the theater. And Butch Burroughs, whom I interviewed, told me when he saw Oswald at his candy counter, and also when he saw him arrested in the theater, and the times, the initial times that Butch Burroughs knew Oswald came into the theater coincided with the timing of the exact time at which Officer Tippit was being killed. Something wrong. Then when he sees Oswald being arrested inside the theater after observing him going from point to point, sitting down beside different people inside the theater, a few minutes later, he sees something else. Now, when I was talking with Butch Burroughs, I just kept asking him different questions in order to understand more what went on that day, and I asked him the question, oh, after Oswald was arrested and taken out the front of the theater, did you see anyone else arrested? And he said, yes, there was another man, looked just like Oswald, who was arrested a few minutes later. He went out. He was taken out the back of the theater. So we've got one Oswald going out the front of the theater, one Oswald going out the back, and then we have Bernard Hare, the hobby shop owner next door, seeing the Oswald being arrested outside the back of the theater, corroborating Butch Burroughs inside the theater. And then we have another witness, a mechanic working at a auto shop a few blocks away, seeing a man who looks just like Oswald being arrested, well, not being arrested, sitting in a car, waiting in a car. A few minutes later, he goes over and he sees him, and he takes down the license plate of the car, and there's another Oswald. Then there's an Oswald who's seen getting onto an airplane by a man who, by accident, is flying in that plane back from Washington, D.C. He got on the wrong plane. That's a remarkable story. I can't begin to tell it in detail on the air, but an Air Force sergeant named Robert Vinson is on a CIA plane in which one of the duplicate Oswalds gets on the plane in Dallas and flies out of there to Roswell, New Mexico. That story in itself you could take up the entire hour telling. There are Oswalds and Oswalds and solid witnesses to them in Dallas on November 22, 1963, totally ignored by Warren Commission media, and when the witnesses come forward and try to tell these stories, they're ignored, wrong questions are asked. Butch Burroughs told me he had never in his life been asked about a second arrest, and so he never said anything to anybody.
Tell us a little bit more about the Oswald that meets this sergeant on a CIA plane.
The sergeant was a very nondescript sort of person, a very modest sort of person. His name, Robert Vinson. He worked at NORAD. He was in the Air Command. He was only a sergeant, but he had a significant security clearance, and he had been passed over in promotions. He felt he had been passed over in promotions. And for the first time in his military career, he appealed above his superiors by going to Washington, D.C. during the week in which the assassination would wind up taking place in order to see if he could achieve a promotion he thought that he was entitled to. So he was there in Washington on Friday, November 22nd, hitching a ride as they were, you could say it was basically a hitch, because in the Air Force, if you went from one place to another, you can get in another Air Force plane and go back to where you'd come from, you know, without paying anything. So he went to Andrews Air Force Base on November 22nd, and he wanted to go back to Colorado Springs, where he worked in the North American Air Defense Command, NORAD. And when he went to the check-in counter, he was told there was nothing scheduled going his way that day. So, you know, he wrote his name down and his serial number on a check-in sheet, and he went for breakfast and asked them to let him know if anything would come through for him. And all of a sudden, a loudspeaker paged him, so he went running out, and he ran for a plane that was pointed out to him that was supposed to depart for Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, and he saw the plane down the runway. It was a C-54, kind of a large cargo plane. So he jumped into the plane because he knew it was going to depart quickly. It had no markings on it. It's not that kind of strange. No military markings or serial numbers. It only had a kind of strange identification on it, on its tail. It was like an egg-shaped Earth. And so he's sitting in the plane, and, you know, normally they check a person in. Nobody checked him in, and two guys who were working outside just suddenly got on the plane and moved into the cockpit, and off the plane went, and he's just sitting there by himself. So to try to speed up the story, he, at 3:30 p.m., as they're flying across the country toward what he hopes is his destination in Colorado, he hears the way he described it to me. He's described it to various interviewers. He heard an unemotional voice say over the intercom, "The president was shot at 12:29. The president was shot at 12:29. And when he heard that, all of a sudden he feels the plane banking into a sharp left turn and begins heading south. And around 3:30, he sees the skyline of a plane of a city. It was Dallas. He knew it was Dallas. He could tell the skyline by the skyline. Then it comes in, and it lands. The plane lands in a kind of rough, sandy area alongside the Trinity River in Dallas. It wasn't a regular runway. It looked like a road under construction, something of that nature. And the plane taxis around in a U-turn, comes to a stop, and then there's two men running toward the plane, and one of the pilots comes back and unlatches the door, and the two men come running in, and Vincent is wondering what the hell is going on. And the two men come aboard. They say nothing to Vincent. They pass his seat. They sit down in the front. They're wearing kind of beige coveralls, and he looks at the men. There was one as kind of tall. He described him as saying he thought he looked Cuban. And the shorter man was, he described him as 5'7 to 5'9, you know, medium weight, 150, something like that, Caucasian. So when he watches, you know, to move ahead very quickly, when he watches the televised events from Dallas later that weekend after this whole experience over, he recognized Lee Harvey Oswald as identical to the shorter man he'd seen board this plane, which was a CIA plane, in Dallas. And without ever having stopped its engines, that C-54 took off from the sandy area and took the man looking like Oswald at the same time as there was a jailed, about to be killed, Lee Harvey Oswald in Dallas. That's the rather big question raised by that one. He was taken to the two men, and he were taken to Roswell Air Force Base in New Mexico. That's where the plane landed. He didn't even know where it was. He thought this certainly isn't Colorado Springs, but the two men who were the pilots and the two men who got on the plane rushed off the plane at this Air Force Base in the dusk. He got off. He found out he was at this Air Force Base in Roswell, and he hitched a ride. Didn't hitch a ride. He took a bus back to his home, and then saw the man who looked exactly like the man he saw on the plane that Sunday. And his wife told him to keep his mouth shut because, first of all, she said, "Are you nuts? It couldn't be him. He's in jail." But he swore, "Well, that's the little guy who got on the plane." And she said, "Well, keep quiet about it." And after that incident, of course, when the people who got on that plane had their debriefing by the intelligence people who were working with them, they no doubt mentioned the other member of their team that they hadn't known much about, known anything about, who was on the plane. And I'm sure the debriefer said, "What other member of the team?" And that's why, for the rest of his military career, Robert Vinson was kept under sharp control, and he had all kinds of people questioning his neighbors and investigating him. He was called to CIA in Washington, D.C. He was offered a job. He turned down the job. He was then sent to a CIA base, and he remained working at Site 51, the CIA's. It was a Blackbird spy plane project at CIA base Site 51, and during that time he worked as a supervisor for base supply. This kind of job he had, and he was given a special funding by the CIA to work at that base. So for the rest of his military career, which was just several years, he was under the control of the CIA. And Robert Vinson, for a couple of decades after his retirement from the military, he said not a word about any of this because he feared for his life. And finally, when the JFK Records Act was passed in 1992, he consulted with a member of Congress and was told that it was now against the law not to speak out, not to provide evidence regarding the JFK assassination. So he came forward, and he appeared on a local television station in Kansas City, and I interviewed him. And it is a truly remarkable story, especially when you see Vincent in an interview, because he is a very ordinary person, but a person who had a piece of the truth, and he came forward and testified to it.
Good. You've investigated with substantial evidence that the Bay of Pigs catastrophe was not a CIA and Pentagon mistake of incompetence, but was in fact meticulously orchestrated to fail in order for the war hawks and the CIA and the Pentagon to isolate JFK and blame him for its failure. So go into how the Bay of Pigs was structured as a kind of black operation in greater detail, and then go into the rationale for why it was designed to fail and the role it played in the greater operation to assassinate President Kennedy. Keeping in mind, if anyone's ever listened to Ray McGovern, he is also a theologian, and he talks about there's actually two CIAs, one that deals with covert operations and which acts as a really evil entity, independent from government oversight and outside the rule of national and international law, And that's not the one that's ever exposed. And you might tie that in, if you have a tie-in, at the time of the JFK's presidency and how it was structured, and describe the amount of influence and power they had over the White House and the government, because if it's true that the Bay of Pigs was intentionally created to fail and blame Kennedy, then that rogue part of the CIA would have had to have been behind it.
Well, one way to get into the CIA's intentions behind the Bay of Pigs is through Alan Dulles' own words. And, of course, Alan Dulles was the director of the CIA at the time. And there's an article that Alan Dulles was planning to write as his response to JFK's indictment of the CIA for manipulating him at the Bay of Pigs. And Alan Dulles was working with a young co-writer in doing this, and he wrote notes for his article defending basically himself and the CIA. And the I think he realized, and the people who were around him realized, he couldn't write such an article. It was just going to be too obvious what was really going on. But the notes exist. Handwritten, coffee-stained notes exist from that article. And they were published in a way that was so revealing that they're called the Confessions of Alan Dulles. And he says in one of his notes, he says that he and his associates knew that, JFK had said beforehand he would never include or he would never approve any combat action by U.S. military forces at the Bay of Pigs. It had to be the Brigade of Exiles. U.S. military forces were not going to go in. He was not going to send in the Marines. But Dulles and his associates knew that condition conflicted with the plan they were foisting on Kennedy. And so, as Dulles wrote in his notes, they discreetly kept silent in the belief. He wrote specifically, quote, "The realities of the situation," he said, "would compel the president to carry out the plan that they wanted, that is, a full-scale military invasion of Cuba by U.S. forces." And this is what he said, quote, "We did not want to raise these issues in talking with the president beforehand in an indecipherable word discussion, which might only harden the decision against the type of action we required. We felt that when the chips were down, when the crisis arose in reality, any action required for success would be authorized rather than permit the enterprise to fail." And what Kennedy said to his, that's Alan Dulles being quoted, and what Kennedy said to his friends after the Bay of Pigs, with regard to both the CIA in particular and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they couldn't believe that a new president like me wouldn't panic and try to save his own face. Well, they had me figured all wrong. In other words, they set him up for an obvious loss to Castro because the terrain was wrong, because there was no uprising. And as a meeting that was held in Cuba after the many years after the Bay of Pigs. In fact, forty years later, in a conference, there were all kinds of people present who analyzed the situation for both Cuba and the United States. And Daniel Shore, the news analyst, was there, and he says, "What became obvious from the documentation is that the CIA overlords of the invasion, Alan Dulles and Richard Bissell, had their own plan of how to bring the United States into the conflict. And, of course, they never expected the uprising against Cuba. What they did expect was that when the invaders established and secured a beachhead, then they could announce the creation of a counter-revolutionary government and appeal for aid from the United States and then push Kennedy into direct American involvement because he couldn't win without it. So as Shore concludes, in effect, Kennedy was the target of a CIA covert operation that collapsed when the invasion collapsed. The CIA even had a plan to supersede Kennedy's decision if he tried to stop the invasion, as he was on the verge of doing before it happened. There were four anti-Castro brigade leaders who told that story. The Cuban's chief CIA military advisor told the brigade leaders what to do if he secretly informed them the entire project would be blocked by the administration, by the president. If this happens, he said, you come here and make some kind of show as if you were going to put us, the advisors, in prison, and you go ahead with the program as we've talked about it, and we'll give you the whole plan, even if we are your prisoners. And when Robert Kennedy learned of that contingency plan to override the president, he called it virtually treason. So it's in that context that Kennedy says, I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds.
One short answer before our last question. After Kennedy fired Alan Dulles and General Cabell and from the CIA and Richard Bissell, is there any evidence that they continue to operate clandestinely in steering the war faction in the CIA?
Well, I guess the evidence would be the ways in which they are, Dulles in particular, moving back into power. In the case of Alan Dulles, he, who is logically, in terms of what we've been describing, a primary, if not the primary, suspect in the assassination of the president, he becomes the fox investigating the murder in the hen house. He becomes the prime mover in the Warren Commission. He becomes the person who, when you read the meetings, transcripts, it's Dulles who right away is talking about a lone assassin. It's Dulles who is even saying in those Warren Commission meetings that if the director of the FBI, Hoover, or if the people who are still in the CIA head positions, of course, Dulles is formally removed from them, if they are asked if Oswald is working for them, he said, even if he were, he would have to lie. Okay, even if a CIA chief were asked if Dulles was working for him, Alan Dulles tells the Warren Commission that man would have to lie. That's a documented by a transcript.
My final question. Explain Ruth and Michael Payne, who befriended Marina and Lee Oswald, and share with us the evidence of the role they played in the plot to set up Oswald as the lone gunman. Ruth was the Warren Commission's chief witness and was the person responsible for introducing Oswald to a major CIA asset. It was also in the storage space owned by the Paynes, who were keeping Oswald's belongings when he moved out of the home with Marina, where the famous backyard photos of Oswald holding the rifle were discovered, all but one which appeared later and is a curious discovery because one would expect them to be found together. So give us this story, please.
Well, you've given the background of Ruth and Michael, but it goes a bit beyond their being friends of the Oswalds. The way in which they met Marina and Lee was through a mutual friend called George DeMorenshield, And George DeMoren's shield was what is known in the intelligence community as a babysitter for Lee Harvey Oswald. He was CIA connected. I already mentioned him earlier. And Marina was a person who was learning English, so Ruth befriended her in order to teach her English. Well, let me go really far ahead and looking back at it through the eyes of J. Edgar Hoover, who writes a letter to the Warren Commission counsel, J. Lee Rankin. This is, you know, a year later after all these events in 1964. And Hoover asks Rankin, the Warren Commission counsel, not to release FBI reports, this is quoting him, Hoover, don't release FBI reports and memoranda dealing with Michael and Ruth Payne and George and Gene DeMoren Shield. And the reason, Hoover says, is making the contents of such documents available to the public could cause certain serious repercussions to the commission. So why is he saying that about Michael and Ruth Payne and George and Gene DeMoren Shield? Well, Payne acknowledged in his testimony that he had a, I'm talking about Michael right now, he had a security clearance, and he didn't say what that classification was. Michael Payne was no ordinary guy. His stepfather, is a man named Arthur Young, was the inventor of the Bell helicopter. In other words, Michael Payne is part of a family who's at the in the heights of the military-industrial complex. And Michael Payne's mother was connected to Alan Dulles. Michael Payne's mother was Ruth Forbes Payne Young, and she was a member of a family in which descended from Ruth. Well, it's a kind of a blue blood family of Boston, and Ruth Forbes Payne Young was a lifelong friend of Mary Bancroft, who was worked side by side with Alan Dulles as a World War II spy in Switzerland. So the family has involvements with Michael Payne. His family has involvements with Alan Dulles. And at one point, Alan Dulles asked a question in the Warren Commission that veered, you know, very close to this. He said to Michael Payne, "Is this Mr. Young your stepfather?" And Payne said, "That's right." And then Dulles changed the subject because it was getting too close to his own involvements and his own background. Ruth Payne's sister worked for the Central Intelligence Agency at the time of the assassination. Ruth Payne, she's the younger sister of Sylvia Hyde Hoke. And it's Sylvia Hyde Hoke was working for the Central Intelligence Agency at the time of the assassination. And Ruth visited her just that summer before she went back to pick up Ruth, went back to pick up Marina Oswald and take her to Dallas. So the intelligence community, is all around the Paynes, and nobody... the Paynes are all around Oswald. The intelligence community is all around the Paynes, and that's what one has to explore as to what the significance of the Paynes is in the JFK assassination.
Professor James Douglas, thank you very much for your outstanding scholarship over the years, and of course, a very important the JFK and the unspeakable. We very much appreciate your contributions to this massive puzzle. And as one might imagine, with thousands of books and tens of thousands of articles and speeches, if we just look at all the information that's out there, some credible, some not, the cynic may be sitting back saying, well, who cares? You know, it's not going to make any news. For those who want the truth, each and every new insight that is credible is important because it clears this muddy water for us and allows us to get a better understanding of what actually happened, who was involved or probable candidates to be involved and you've certainly brought us a sense of scholarship and insight that we otherwise would not have had. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Gary Noll. I appreciate you all taking your time to listen, and the entire series available on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, the archive. Have a nice day. We'll be right back.